Welcome to the Urban Astronomer Podcast. Wow, I can't believe it's been 3 weeks since the last episode of the Urban Astronomer Podcast. Although, it actually has not been that long. In the wake of Hurricane Harvey, I recorded a special episode for the Hurricane Harvey Podcast Pack. This is a fundraising project to help deal with the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey, and it's organized by Justin Corbett, who is a podcaster and a comics editor and creator. The episode I recorded is available as part of a pack of other specially produced podcasts for sponsors of the project. So if you want to hear it, you need to donate a bit of money at the link that you'll find on the show notes at www.urban-astronomer.com. All proceeds will be divided between two funds that have been set up for aid and reconstruction purposes, so it's a pretty good cause, and I urge you to support it. Many years ago, I was looking for old school friends on Facebook, and I was thrilled to find that one of them now works at the South African Astronomical Observatory. Simon Fishley is not an astronomer, but he is the head of IT at SAAO, so I gave him a call and I asked if he would like to talk about his job with us. Now, I normally only interview people who are directly connected to astronomy in South Africa, either South Africans working in the field or foreign astronomers who come to South Africa to do their research. But the fact is that astronomy provides a huge range of employment options. It's such a multidisciplinary field that needs so many different skills that it's worth talking about ways to have a job working with astronomers and giant telescopes that don't need a science degree. So, I present to you Simon Fishley, whose career path matches my own in so many oddly specific ways, and who currently holds my dream job.
My name is Simon Fishley. I currently am the head of IT at the South African Astronomical Observatory in Cape Town.
So what is your interest in astronomy, if any? I mean, are you an expert in the field, or you're a scientist, or just a hobbyist? Or is this just a job that happens to be, you know, tied in?
That's how it started. It was just a job that happened to be at an observatory. IT, as you probably know, is quite a portable skill. Uh-huh. And I find myself there through a series of fortunate events.
What were they?
Well, I started off at Maritzburg University studying law and psychology, but I was pretty bad at that. So I graduated, I was at a bit of a loose end. I didn't want to carry on with law, which was the plan. I'd always been interested in computers just from a hobbyist perspective. I'd never learned any programming or anything like that. But I'd broken my own PC a couple of times and had to figure out how to fix it. And
that's the best training, yeah.
Yep, that's the school of hard knocks, eh? Mm-hmm. A friend of mine and I had been very keen on it together, and he had moved down to Cape Town. I spent a few months living at home with my folks, helping my dad out, and then he had an opportunity to open an IT company. And he called me up and said, look, I've got one client. I need some help. So I threw my life in my car and drove to Cape Town from Natal, and we opened a company called Personal Computing Systems in 1999. And for this next 8 months, we sold Y2K cards, getting everybody ready for the big collapse, the millennium bug.
Y2K cards? What do you mean, like a certificate or?
No, it was a little PCI card or ISA card that you put into a PC, and it effectively replaced the onboard clock with a clock that was Y2K compliant.
Oh, okay. It's funny because we were dealing with it as well. I was at a PC shop, but we were dealing our own PCs that we sold that were already, you know, up to date. I didn't know there was such a thing.
Yeah. So it was just basically hauling backwards compatibility, or making computers backwards compatible or forwards compatible, I guess. Yeah. So people didn't want to replace their entire suite of PCs, so they just banged in these cards at 200 rand a pop or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. It was very easy money. And it turns out they weren't really needed. But anyway.
Yeah.
That was established. Mm-hmm. And from there, we quickly got tired of handing over email and internet business to MWeb. So I downloaded a copy of Red Hat 4 or 5 at that stage. and suddenly we were hosting web pages on Apache something very early. And then they wanted email, so to quickly learn how QML works, because that seemed to be the way to go at that stage. Although for the first couple of weeks, all the emails that went through our server said they were transferred with a trial version of something that we before we figured out QML properly. So it was like stuck in the footer of each email, highly professional.
You are the only person I've ever met, apart from me, who uses QML.
Not anymore. Not anymore. I've converted to PostFix, but QML was my go-to. No.
Okay, there we go.
It was a legacy thing, you know. I just inherited the PostFix servers, and well, yeah, the rest of history. But yeah, I rebuilt an ISP and overhauled it and ran it all in QML, and it was perfect. It really worked well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was it, basically. That's how I got into the Linux side of things and haven't really looked back from that. We sold up the company a couple of years later. We got bought out by a bigger ISP who just absorbed our clients, and our hardware clients went to another company. And then I traveled for a bit overseas. And then I came back and got a real job where someone else paid me. So I wasn't working for peanuts, because working for yourself is not all it's cracked up to be. And that was at a company. I started as a Windows server engineer, but the guys that were running their ISP left, but pretty much simultaneously. And the bosses said to me, look, you had ISP in your CV. Can you do something? And I said, well, yes, but this ISP is kind of old and broken. So if you can give me some money, I can make it a good ISP. And that was just about the time that ADSL was becoming a reality in South Africa. So I became a internet solutions reseller and started selling uncapped ADSL solutions to corporates left, right, and center. And we grew very, very quickly with all of that business coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to effectively overhaul ISP. We were now making money from this ADSL service. And so I built everything from the ground up, which was really fun. And did that for a couple of years until everything was working. And then I changed scenery and moved to the Free State for a while. Another friend that I'd worked with previously was working up there in the Drakensberg, and we had a whole lot of Drakensberg hotels as clients, and we did email and wireless hotspots for the hotels, and backhaul connectivity up to chicken farms and all sorts of interesting things.
Okay.
And it was an interesting life up there. And then somebody who'd taken over from me at the ISP then said, got in touch and said, I've got a friend who works at the observatory and they've got a job going. Maybe you'd be interested. My personal circumstances at that stage was such that my girlfriend didn't want to be in the Free State anymore. So I applied, and the observatory flew me down, had an interview. I had a telephone interview first. And I remember one of the questions was, how many square meters of AstroTurf do you think there are in South Africa? Which was a bizarre question. You know, one of that sort of interview.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they liked me and they liked what I'd done. And the guy who'd recently taken over the department was trying to build a bit of a more customer-centric department. And so I had a nice mix of technical skill and customer-facing experience. So I got the job, and I started on the 1st of January 2009. And that was a serious learning curve. I mean, before I'd always figured stuff out, got along, made things work, but I mean, this was a professional operation. And there was a very steep learning curve, and that continues today. And there's always something every day, which is what I really enjoy about the job.
Mm-hmm.
And then in December 2015, my boss made a career change, and I assumed his role. So that's when I became the head of IT, which is now 18 months and counting.
Well, congratulations then. A bit belated, but you know.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So what then... How does an IT department at an observatory or any kind of research thing, how is it different from IT in a commercial or ISP environment?
In a lot of ways, it's the same. You've got the same pressures of performance and uptime. People are as uncompromising as they are in corporate.
Mm-hmm.
I think we get a bit of leeway in that if the internet does go down or something, a server fails and there's a bit of downtime, the world isn't going to end. Millions of dollars aren't going to be lost. But I mean, we do lose productive time, and some telescopes, I mean, SALT especially, it even though it's not an actual monetary cost, we lose money when it's not running in terms of Sky time being right. lost. I think when you did an interview with Dion Bester a while back, mm-hmm. and it's something like you could equate it to costing about $1,000 an hour to run the telescope. So if the telescope stands for an IT reason, we're wasting money.
I see, yeah.
So we do build a lot of redundancy into our systems. It doesn't need the internet to run, but a lot of our stuff is virtualized now. So ensuring that we've got proper redundancy in terms of virtual servers and effective backups of those servers if they do fail and contingency plans in place, that's relatively important. Other than that, what else is different from corporate world versus... I think our users are a different caliber. You're dealing with very smart people that will not think twice before writing a script to solve a problem or really tackling problems themselves. So when the astronomers come to us with a problem, it's generally a real problem. That's not a quick fix. And we generally, all right, I'll get back to you. And then we go and Google it because, you know, Google is a certain friend.
It's the number one tool. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So from that perspective, it's always challenging. You know, there's the day to day. I can't print. My Wi-Fi is not working. Have you turned it on? But there's also a lot of very challenging stuff that keeps us busy and keeps us interested.
Do you spend most of your time then in Cape Town, or do you travel up to Sutherland? Or,
well, we're a team of seven between Cape Town and Sutherland. When I first joined, we didn't have any permanent IT staff in Sutherland, mm-hmm. but we've grown quite a lot up there now. I think we've got 23 or 24 separate facilities up on the plateau in Sutherland now. A mixture of South African telescopes and international collaborations and wholly owned international experiments. So there's a lot to do up there. It really is the sharp end. So I now have two permanent employees. Well, one permanent, one long-term contract. So they take care of the day-to-day up in Sutherland. They're effectively both technicians. And then in Cape Town, we have a systems engineer who's the newest hire on my team. He joined us in February. And then I've got two senior systems admins who look after the day-to-day running of systems. I've got a help desk technician. We run something called Request Tracker, which is seriously core to our operations. We pride ourselves on being very, very customer-centric and always giving our users the best possible service. Mm-hmm. And they've come to expect it from us. I can say without any conceit, we have a very good reputation within the astronomy community in South Africa and within the NRF, the National Research Foundation, of being a pretty good IT department. We're proud of that and we try and keep it that way. Mm-hmm. And the help desk really is fundamental to making sure we don't let things slip through the cracks. Then we've got a web developer. He, in addition to looking after our websites, and there's a plethora of those, he's also recently been involved in building interfaces for some of our new telescope control systems. So we are on a trajectory towards fully remotely operable telescopes. Some of them already are, and we're upgrading all the equipment in the domes and that sort of thing so they can all be operated remotely.
Right.
And that obviously requires a robust and reliable web interface. And so my web dev has done a lot of work on that with another developer, a PhD, I think he has a PhD in astronomy, or it could be a synergistic discipline, but he did the sort of back-end stuff and very funky front ends that drive all the filter wheels on the telescopes, and you can open and close the domes. It tells you when it starts raining, all that sort of stuff. So okay. Yeah, that's the team. So we do rotate up to Sutherland, not as much anymore because we have permanent staff up there, but I like all of my guys to go up at least twice a year just to stay in touch with what's happening in Sutherland.
I would think it'd be something of a privilege, frankly, to drive up there on a regular basis.
Well, yeah. I was working out the other day. I've done something like 70 weeks up there. So it gets the shine does wear off a little bit. Uh-huh. It's still an amazing place, and I really enjoy the people up there. But my personal circumstances are changed. So I'm married, and my wife has a little girl, and I sort of enjoy being around them, I don't like missing out on galas and things like that. So 8 days in Sutherland does sometimes, you know, chafe a bit, but it's part of the job and we all enjoy going up there. So 2 weeks a year is hardly a hardship.
Yeah, yeah. Are you guys going to be heavily involved in SKA, or are they going to have their own people?
They do have their own IT department. It's still very much in its formative stages. There's still lots going on that side. It's very much an organization that's still trying to figure out who it is. So as I understand it, and I'm not an astronomer, but we will work quite closely with them once Meerkat's online. There's a telescope being assembled as we speak in Sutherland at the moment called Meerlicht, and it's a Dutch-South African collaboration, if I'm not mistaken. And it will effectively do simultaneous observations of whatever SKA happens to be recording at that time. It'll be taking optical images of the same area. And then I think they'll be processed at the same time. We in the process of discussing how we get that data from Sutherland into the processing center in UCT in pretty much real time at the moment. We're fortunate in that we do have a fairly decent internet connection. We've got a gigabit fiber that links Sutherland directly with Cape Town over 10net. Yeah. So moving data is a lot easier than it used to be when we used to drive hard drives up and down on the bus. For a long time, we ran the observatory on a 2 meg diginet link, and then we got two meg diginet links, so things got a lot faster.
Yeah.
It's quite a jump going from 4 megabits to 1,000. The synergies between SKA between radio and optical really are definitely there. And there's actually a shift at the moment within South African astronomy. You may have seen the announcement recently. The Minister of Science and Technology announced that they're now forming the SARAO, the South African Radio Astronomical Observatory, I think.
Okay.
Effectively, Hartrau and SKA are merging into one organization, which will look after all the Africa. So we'll have an optical arm and we'll have the radio arm, and then there's a big push towards multi-wavelength astronomy in South Africa. So having two discrete organizations side by side it seems to make a lot of sense. I'm not a politician, but that seems to be the thinking at the moment at the upper echelons.
Well, it's nice that the politicians are thinking like this, because the scientific value is enormous from this.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, astronomy is definitely a jewel in the South African science landscape's crown. So we do enjoy the attention, and we try and make the best of the resources that are made available to us.
Yeah. I've seen a few of your photographs that you've taken when you were in Sutherland. How long have you been doing that?
Basically, since I started at the observatory, I'm very much an amateur. I know nothing really about apertures, and I mean a little bit, but it's really just a function of being in Sutherland often enough with beautiful dark skies and a camera and time on my hands. So a whole lot of trial and error allowed me to get to a point where I can take photos like that with pretty basic equipment. I mean, most of the ones that the images that you're probably talking about were taken with my 18-55 kit lens. It's just fortunate that Sutherland is so dark that even a really rubbish piece of glass like that can get a decent image.
Well, I use mine exact same lens quite a bit as well. So they're quite serviceable.
Absolutely. No, look, I'm being unfair to the lens, but when I bought a 50mm f1.8 Canon little fixed lens and just exposed that for 10 seconds, the difference is unbelievable.
Yeah. There's
so much more light gathering power, and then unfortunately 50 mils is a bit too close, so you start getting star trails very quickly. But you can stack images like that because you can do nice short exposures so you don't get the star trail. So yeah, I mean, I spent a bit of time figuring out software so I can stack images, and learned a bit of Photoshop type stuff so I could adjust them a bit, but very much an amateur. I do enjoy it though. It's very satisfying getting something else. I think my favorite is star trails, you know, point towards the pole and just let them spin, come back, fetch the camera a couple of hours later.
Yeah. Okay.
Some amazing photos. that I've got a bit better equipment, and also hobbyists, basically. I mean, the one guy is he's a software developer in Salt. He basically wrote, he's been on the team for at least 14, 15 years, I think, since the project's inception. And yeah, he rocks a really nice Canon 5D, and he's got some really nice glass that goes with it. And his images are unbelievable. They're really, really good. Mm-hmm. But he's one of several. I mean, these guys are, it's amazing to work with really talented, smart people. I'm constantly overawed with some of them. You know, they really are impressive people.
Yeah. I get the impression, though, that SAS staff seem to be not just a bright bunch, but very, very passionate. They're really into what they do, which must be amazing to work with.
It is, yeah. I expect there's a lot of industries like that, where you work with really driven and passionate people. But astronomy is a calling. I wouldn't say you go into astronomy for the money. I mean, I think it's a relatively well-paid, I mean, you can earn a good living, but there's not a huge avenue for advancement. There's not a lot of huge senior posts that are going to allow you to buy a mansion and, you know, live the rock star life. Mm. And being an astronomer, the rock star life, it is not. It's long, cold hours. In winter, these guys, they'll easily pull a 15, 16-hour night. The sun goes down at 5 o'clock, and they'll have to get up to the telescope. They do prep before, and then they're there the entire night. And then, you know, they go down, they'll have breakfast, and then they'll sleep, and they'll get up, and they'll do it again for 8 or 16 days in a row. And it's exhausting. And then once that's done, then you've got mountains of data, and you've got to then get back to Cape Town, and you've got to analyze that data in amongst filling forms to apply for grants, to travel to conferences, to arrange this and do that. And I mean, it's a lot of work. And
so this is the scientists you're talking about, not the technicians, yeah. Or the, okay.
Yeah, those are the scientists. From the technical perspective, as I said, it's always new. It's always interesting. So there's not a lot of space for boredom. There's always interesting challenges, and there's always opportunity to try something new. One of my focuses is just trying to make our astronomers' lives easier. So understanding what they do is important. So I've spent several nights sitting with astronomers for hours at a time, just watching how they work, talking to them about what they're doing, so I can better understand what it is that might make their lives easier. So that results in things like we run OwnCloud, for instance, which is a open source Dropbox alternative. But instead of having the stuff stored up in someone else's servers, we use our own data, in our own storage. So we control the data all the time, and we leverage the resources that we already have. And it gives them exactly the same functionality that Dropbox does, sort of sync and share. And yeah, so just little innovations like that that try and make life easier. So I had a user the other day sharing like 650 gigs of data via Dropbox.
Must have been expensive.
Yeah, well, I mean, we don't pay for bandwidth. I mean, we don't pay for traffic. You know, we have an unlimited connection, and our ISP is really good. I mean, I have a lot of respect for the guys at Tenet, and Sanrin as well, the South African National Research and Education Network. They stitch the whole fabric together, and by and large, they do a fantastic job under sometimes very trying circumstances.
Mm.
And funny enough, that Sanrin uses Seacom, and which this is completely irrelevant. The cable comes ashore at Mtanzini, where I grew up. I don't know if you remember that. I was obviously in the boarding school, but
I grew up in the north.
And South Africa's fastest undersea cable comes ashore in this little seaside hamlet on the north coast of KwaZulu-Natal.
Oh.
And the town benefited from it. You've got the terabits of internet capacity coming along, and you've still got dial-up modems in the houses.
It's off on the way, though.
Yeah,
it goes right past. Okay, if I had to ask you for advice as somebody looking, say, leaving school or looking to study and wanted to work, not necessarily as a scientist, but in a scientific or research environment like what you're doing now, what would you tell them?
So with recent experience, I can honestly say that there's two things that I recommend any young aspiring IT practitioner, specifically in a scientific environment, should learn. One of them is learn out how Linux works. It's disheartening to see so many kids coming out of colleges and universities and they can only Windows. And it really is like trying to do things with one hand tied up behind your back with a blindfold on, if you ask me. So some sort of properly capable operating system is fundamental. And then on top of that, learn to code. Be it learn how to write a bash script, learn how to write a script in Python. There's any number of languages. Those are the two that I'm possibly proficient on. And I mean, we joined a DST internship program last year where the DST funds an intern for us for a year.
That's the Department of Science and Technology.
Yes.
Okay.
So DST have several thousand applicants a year, and it's growing every year. Last year, I think they placed 540 interns around the country, which is really good. I mean, it's a fantastic program. Hmm. And I was given a bushel of CVs to sift through, and I picked a couple, phoned the guys up, and chatted to them, and then I just had to pick one. Sight unseen. And then 6 weeks later, this guy arrives with a suitcase and is like, "Hi, I'm here for my internship." And he was fantastic. we really got lucky. He grabbed opportunity with both hands. He took on any single job that I chucked at him, and I really chucked him in the deep. And I was like, "Well, here's a computer. Here's an internet connection. See if you can get Ubuntu installed. It's got Windows on, so just take that off and put Ubuntu on." So that was his first step. He'd never ever worked on Linux before, and he did it. He cracked it in a day, and then
well, that's pretty good going.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Google's a useful resource, and he found walkthroughs, and he built himself a bootable USB, and he had it up and running chop chop.
That's good.
And then, yeah, we worked out a program, and we just exposed him to pretty much everything we do at the observatory, which is hugely varied. Yeah. We try and do everything in-house. The only thing I outsource is networking, because if I ever have to crimp another network cable, it'll be too soon. But, yeah, we run our own storage. We look after all of that. Our firewalls, our printers we own and operate, and we have a couple of contracts, but we run our own print server. We run our own PBX. So there's a huge amount to be exposed to, but fundamental to that, learn Linux, learn Python, or learn Bash.
Great stuff. I am basically out of questions here. Is there anything you would like to plug, or otherwise, if you'd like people to be able to talk, ask you questions, can they reach you on social media or somewhere?
Yeah. I have a presence on the internet. I don't know where I'm most active, actually. I don't know, maybe my Twitter, but yeah, I mean, most of it's all personal stuff. I kind of, maybe just my work email, you know, stick it in the comments of the,
all right, we'll do that.
Podcast with people and drop me a mail. Yeah, okay. That's the easiest. I have a website, but it's broken more often than it's working. You know, like the plumber's bathroom has always got the leaky tap. It's the same with IT.
And the mechanic's car, and yeah. All right,
I encourage people to come and visit the observatory. It's a fantastic place. Mm-hmm. Making a trip to Sutherland is worthwhile, but you can also visit Cape Town. I think a lot of people don't know that we have open nights twice a month, the second and fourth Saturdays of every month. We have a public talk, which normally starts at about 8 p.m. And then if the weather's good, we've got a grand old 100-something-year-old telescope that has a hydraulic floor that we open up and point at whatever is interesting in the sky. Yeah, the McLean.
Is it McLean or McLear?
McLean. Well,
I thought there was an R.
The Victoria telescope inside the dome, but it's the McLean dome.
Okay.
Interestingly, the McLear is, I think, buried on our site. He was a surveyor here in the Cape, and McLear's beacon on the top of Table Mountain was his beacon.
That's the confusion.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, the McLean Dome is, we got a little museum there, which is obviously open on the open nights. There's no charge, and the talks are cool because more often than not, the astronomers make it understandable for us humans who don't have a PhD in astrophysics.
Mm-hmm.
because yeah, it's a pretty complex subject that they're normally really good at translating down to understandable. So that's quite fun. And then obviously a trip to Sutherland is worthwhile. We've got a bit of a visitor center up there. There are day tours of the site where they take you around, show you a couple of telescopes, and then they also have stargazing sessions at night if the weather's good. We've got a 14-inch and a 16-inch, which take the crowd into, you wrap up tight and have a look and see what's up in the sky.
Of course, there is a whole range of other jobs that need doing at big research institutes like this. They hire all sorts, from janitors to admin clerks to engineers. Basically, all of the people that any large organization needs to keep things moving, and the specialists and technicians to build and operate the machinery and instruments that the scientists use. Next week, though, it's all about the science. I'll be chatting to Dr. Michelle Doherty, who was born and educated in South Africa before getting a job overseas, working as mission scientist on a number of robotic space missions. Her biggest and most recognizable job so far was as the lead scientist for the magnetometer on the Cassini mission, which ended just a few days ago when the spacecraft was deliberately crashed into Saturn. Now, she's a very busy woman, as you can imagine, so I was really excited when she agreed to let me interview her. I cannot wait to share that conversation with you, but you're going to have to tune in next week to hear it. If you don't want to miss out, I would strongly recommend subscribing in your favorite podcast software, whether it be iTunes or Stitcher or pretty much anything that lets you subscribe to a podcast feed. Just search for Urban Astronomer or point it to www.urban-astronomer.com/podcast to have it automatically download every episode recorded so far, and then just keep downloading them as new ones are released for you to listen to at your own convenience. Or, if that is too much of a commitment, you can just carry on visiting the website and listen to it directly in your browser. As always, I would love to hear from you and look forward to reading all of your comments and reviews. You can use the comments section at the end of the show notes for this episode, or you can just send an email to podcast@urban-astronomer.com, or you can tweet me at @uastronomer. And I think that's everything. So yeah, thank you for listening. I wish you the clearest of skies, and I will see you next week.